Back in the 5th century, apparently married soldiers who were otherwise forbidden to wed. Then to one of the French courts of love designated this their day for considering various lovers' disputes. Chaucer linked this day to love with his lovebirds in the Parliament of Birds, and Hamlet's Ophelia talks of Valentine's Day. In any case, ever since, Valentine's Day has figured in literature, art, and popular culture as a focus for love and lovers. But even in this brief look at some of the possible origins of this day, we have a mingling of various kinds of love: passionate, romantic, murderous, reproductive, charitable, and of course Christian. And each of these has its own history, as well as links to Freud and psychoanalysis, and psychoanalytic ways of thinking, which of course underline ambivalence, so that love is never just love. It trails hate with it, and various kinds of perhaps murderous impulses. I go over this very, very brief in history that you know, just because it's quite clear to me that in some measure all of this is internalized by us and affects our contemporary experience of love. At a time now where sex is a public and, of course, not only a private matter. You may argue that it was public in different ways at the time when Freud was alive, but it wasn't public in our way. And indeed, some, and I think I'm one of them, would argue that there is now a disciplinary injunction to have sex in at least 50 shades and in as many lustful positions and orientations as possible, and tell everyone about it, an injunction that has taken over perhaps from the older superego prohibitive injunctions. And it, as a consequence, we also have different demarcations of what might be secret and what can be spoken, even to ourselves. Am I making funny noises? I've got an echo. I'm sorry. Well, whether the current settlement makes us any happier or more satisfied than the older one is something that will no doubt be addressed in the course of what promises to be a passionate day, at least for debate. We're going to begin in this morning's papers by time-traveling through history and ending up with a present of love from Freud's classical antecedents with Miriam Leonard and Daniel Orrell's, through the early courts of romantic love and into the romantic era with Jane O'Grady, and then look at, after the coffee break, look at masculinity and desire with Candida Yates. Ivan Ward asked me to make some introductory remarks for the conference, sparked by a revisiting of one of my books, ambitiously called All About Love. I'll flash it so my publishers will be very happy. The book has the subtitle Anatomy of an Unruly Emotion, and I stress the unruly, even though this particular book is an attempt to look at some of the more beneficent aspects of love without necessarily bringing constantly in train the kinds of crimes that I look at in Trials of Passion, or indeed the history of madness and love. And the way I structured this book was as a kind of life history of love. I followed an arc from childhood to old age while drawing on history and literature and, of course, psychoanalytic thinking of various kinds. The structure is not, because I'm a follower of the American analyst Eric Fromm and have a belief that we necessarily mature in our understandings of love as we age. Quite the opposite can be the case. Many of us retain early models of ourselves relatively untarnished, still wild, and seem happy or unhappy enough to pursue various patterns that belong back in kind of Oedipal days, and indeed recreate our maddening, obsessional, adolescent lusts, or what I characterize as first love in the book. It's a term that, of course, doesn't come from psychoanalysis, but dates back a long time. And in terms of psychoanalysis, of course, and indeed in Turgenev's own book of that name, first love is never the first. It always harks back, because many of us retain early models of ourselves quite intact. You remember the wonderful line from the film Moonstruck, I don't know if we're going to be seeing this with Candida or not, in which an aging, philandering lecturer, I don't know if the verbal slippage is responsible for the profession, when rebuked by a mature woman with the words, "You're too old for her," aptly replies, "I'm too old for me." And I kind of feel like that at the moment. That said, there are definitely shifts and changes as one moves through life, particularly if we think of our first and often overwhelming loves as passionate elaborations of physical functions. As we age, our vitality, Pache, Viagra, the lures of seniors, diminishes. Different configurations of love take on a new importance. Though we keep the various strata alive in ourselves, we may move on from adolescent loves in groups, then in couples, which are always shadowed by triangles, then to reawakened love in triangular formations, whether with lovers or when that wonderful third person, the baby, arrives, and then love for our children, and so on. I've recently become a grandmother, and I mention this because my temptation was to bring you pictures of my grandson. And for the first time, I think I really understand why the ancients imagined Cupid, or Eros, as a delicious baby, this adorable, troublesome, unruly, libidinous character who playfully wreaks havoc, whose presence is ever fleeting, so that he becomes an object of intense longing. This, of course, reminds me of the wonderful footnote in Freud's, in the first of Freud's three essays on sexuality, where comparing women to men, he notes that the first failed to exhibit any sexual overvaluation towards men, but they scarcely ever failed to do so towards their own children. I don't know if he was thinking about Martha, or whatever, but I'm sure that the ancients, observing their women folk with their children, thought that yes, perhaps Eros is this unruly child and a very good representation of love. He, of course, grows into as well and can be represented as well as this nubile adolescent, but the baby form is the form that's stuck through time. Anyhow, thinking of love in terms of an arc through life provided me in All About Love with a skeleton on which to hang a very vast subject and distill observations both historical as well as contemporary. The historical is always important in this area of love because we carry history, we carry imaginative elaborations, we carry literature, film, story, both individual, both in our family patterns, if you like, and cultural. And we're always haunted by our own ghosts and the narratives and images that exist in our culture. Our earliest childhood lacks and joys, pleasures, plenitude, dependencies, polymorphous perversities, Oedipal configurations, envies, yearnings, lay down those templates that we rehearse as well as live slightly differently and with variation through life. And as you'll see in the course of this day, all the configurations of love have a history. Romance has a history through courtly love. And those, for example, are retranslated not only in Pride and Prejudice, say, but in our own Bridget Jones. And indeed, very, very closely in 50 Shades of Grey, whatever the sexual permutations. Though I don't know if any of you read this rather wonderful review of the film, in which the only thing that's really prohibited in our culture and therefore is most appealing are the pancakes that Grey encourages our great lover to seek, to eat, sorry, not to seek, but to seek and to eat. I mean, food is the last area of taboo, perhaps, for women. It's what we're not allowed to enjoy. We're allowed all the other configurations of sex. I don't know what Freud would have said about all this, but never mind. So, go back to where, what I've put down here for you. So at the same time, I think I hope somebody today will be talking about the internet and the virtual sphere with its dating sites, because I think that has inflected our experiences of love very differently. The romantic, the sexual, the pornographic, take your pick, there are sites for all kinds of dating. And this, of course, affects the way we think of love. It has made us imagine, I think, that we and our potential lovers can be contained in answers on questionnaires, that they're people we freely choose and somehow control with a click, which, of course, and studies have been done about this, the click itself is a site of satisfaction. And all of this has given us an illusion that we choose or have been chosen freely. This control, this internalized notion of free choice, which is very much part of our capitalist ethos, has, I think, also given a different weight to the idea of consent. I don't know how many of you have been following the arguments about consent and that terrible arc from consent to rape, which is now very much in the limelight in America because of new regulations on campus, and where consent is now something that almost has to be written every time you engage in a date. Otherwise, there are possibilities that rape accusations will ensue. And I think this is a very tricky area, and indeed one for psychoanalytical thinking to come into play, because as we all know, consent is never just consent, and no's are never necessarily just no's. And I say this as a feminist. I don't say this as somebody who thinks that women are somehow weak-minded. So sex, as Freud so convincingly showed us, is rarely mere lust. Even in the German sense of lust, which actually also takes in pleasure and isn't only carnal, necessarily carnal in the English sense. So it takes in not only all our sexual configurations, but more than that. It calls up some of the most intense, most difficult feelings we have, from guilt and hate to desire for status and power to fear, disgust, obsession, humiliation, and indeed a host of symptoms. All of these exist alongside and within the thing we call love. It's there, of course. Love is there in its lack, and it's there in conscious attempts at celibacy, Freud would tell us. One of the many contradictions of our times is that, of course, sex is everywhere and marketed as a good, sometimes an ecstatic good, but like love, sex has long had a place on the health and disorder charts. In Mad, Bad, and Sad, an earlier book, I quoted the first Betham list of causes of madness back in the early 1800s. And even there, when, you know, we were in a very different kind of time, love ranked third, just below, you'd be interested to know, religion and grief as a cause of institutionalization, as a cause of being sent to Bethlehem. In Trials of Passion, I traced love's aberrations into the courts, where the mind doctors had an early place in deciding between what was criminal and what was crazy. And indeed, in our own day, where we have laws about stalking and so on, this darker side of love, forensic psychiatry and psychotherapy are a growth area in our courts. One of the conundrums of love, particularly in relationship to contemporary coupledom and marriage, is that we desire security and simultaneously desire. In other words, we wish both for ruly and unruly loves. And whether it's possible to domesticate the sexual without discouraging it is a problem Freud addressed, as did the contemporary philosopher Stanley Cavell, very interestingly, and indeed sometimes in relationship to rom-coms of the 40s, those very, very great films with fast-witted talk, where remarriage becomes the way to happy, settled love. Another complicating factor in our love settlements is that in our global cities and virtual communities, sex is something that is lustfully desired, and simultaneously something that is prohibited, reviled by fundamentalists of various persuasions. So it's not a kind of completely felicitous picture. We also socially contain our other in this global world, and indeed in all our Western capitals. Women bear themselves publicly or cover up to go into public. Gay marriage is at one and the same time an accepted good, but simultaneously for many a crime. Our excess seems to have as many discontents as our austerity. And like fundamentalisms of any kind, our culture is also adept at splitting and putting all bad love into one basket. And I don't know whether we're going to talk about pedophilia and child abuse, but it's very interesting to me, and I kind of wonder at it, because I'm so old now, because I've seen so many generational shifts, the way in which the only remaining area of taboo for us, if you're not a Christian or a Muslim or another kind of fundamentalist, the only area of taboo is child abuse. Sexuality, in other words, what we now call pedophilia. And it's as if all our horror has gone there, whereas before it used to be far more widely distributed, that we had different kinds of taboos. So we have the taboo of food for women, if you like, in 50 Shades of Grey. It's the one area of real pleasure, apparently, in the film. I haven't seen it. And we have this area of pedophilia. Anyhow, to turn more directly to Freud, my sense is that the whole project of psychoanalysis, of course, hinges on love. Although in Britain, history for long stretches took sex out of the analytic equation and concentrated on the love between mothers and babies, or indeed parents and babies. For Freud, love, libido, and sex are everywhere. Perhaps it's one of the many things that he learned from the poets and the novelists, who were his teachers, alongside, of course, his patients. Love, whether in its libidinous force, the elaborations of these entail, or in its ambivalences, its hauntings, its repetitions, its Oedipal wildness, is everywhere in Freud's work. Psychoanalysis, as many have pointed out, of course, begins with a love story. It begins with Joseph Breuer's treatment of Bertha Pappenheim, The Case of Anna O, which is the founding myth of psychoanalysis. And for Freud, it's a first example of what he would later call transference love, that very particular, potentially therapeutic relationship between a doctor, a therapist, and a patient. You might say that's a case, that's an area of mistaken identity, but in any case, it's still love, and it's the origin of transference love in this first early case. So just to indicate a few of the places where love and libido feature in Freud's work, love is the link between humans and the propelling force of development. It's also the precipitating factor in the emergence of symptoms. It's what goes wrong in relationships and marriage. It's the Oedipal basis of the family. It's the shaping or misshaping narcissism of self-love. We love our ego ideals, and our identifications proceed through them. For the Viennese male, as for many since, there where he desires, he does not love, and there where he loves, he does not desire. We fall ill of the loss of love. The hope of therapy is the return of the ability to love. In the last resort, we must begin to love in order not to fall ill, Freud says. Finally, as his essay on Gradiva, the popular 1906 novel by Jensen, shows, psychoanalysis, though never as good or able to go as far as the real thing, in other words, consummated love in the real world, not in the therapeutic chamber, is nonetheless a cure through love. And I'll just finish so that the day can move on without me. Well, I'll be here in the chair, and so that we have more time for questions. I'm going to finish very quickly with a quote from Gradiva itself, where Freud is analyzing the novella and taking his cue from the happy ending that his female readers, he says all female readers, it's another story, desire. And just as a footnote, you remember that Freud said that his case histories took their cue from women's popular romances. I'll just take a little chunk of that and read it out to you, because I think this is the place where he begins to think of transference and counter-transference as what happens to lovers, and it's what replays itself in the analytic chamber. For those of you who don't know this, the storyline of the novel is that the delusional Norbert, I don't know if you're going to come back to this with your classical work, but Norbert reimagines his childhood friend Zoe as the Gradiva, who is about to die in Pompeii, and he meets her on the site of... is this taking over from where you are? Okay. and in any case, Zoe makes him live through all his delusions, and by doing so then allows him to come back to himself, but himself as the lover of Zoe, which he always has been. Anyhow, and Freud says, the process of cure in this fictional couple is accomplished in a relapse into love, if we combine all the many components of the sexual instinct under the term love. And such a relapse is indispensable, for the symptoms on account of which the treatment has been undertaken are nothing other than precipitates of earlier struggles connected with repression or the return of the repressed. And they can only be resolved and washed away by a fresh high tide of the same passions. Every psychoanalytic treatment is an attempt at liberating repressed love, which has found a meager outlet in the compromise of a symptom. Indeed, the agreement between such treatments and the process of cure described by the author of Gradiva reaches its climax in the further fact that in analytic psychotherapy, two, the reawakened passion, whether it is love or hate, invariably chooses as its object the figure of the doctor. So, there you go. That's the basis not only of Freud's analysis of love, but of where psychotherapy will somehow reignite those early passions and transform them into a cure, a kind of cure, an ability to love again, if you like. Gradiva is, of course, all about the antique world, so let me now turn you over to Miriam Leonard and Daniel Orles. I don't know who's going to go first. Is it? You're going to go together, okay. Who are going to talk to us about Freud and Greek love. Miriam Leonard is Professor of Greek Literature and its Reception at University College London, and author of several books, including Socrates and the Jews, from Moses Mendelssohn to Sigmund Freud. There are a lot of other books which you can see in your abstracts pages. Daniel Orles is Associate Professor of Classics at Warwick, and his new book, just out I think, is called Sex, Antiquity and Its Legacy. I'm not sure if this is in the program because I haven't quite looked, but we're going to take questions after each talk, because that will A, allow more space on platform, but also allow people like me not to forget what has been said, because the next talk then comes and takes its place. So, please, will you mic them up, Ivan? Yes, or Francesco? Thank you.
Micing people up as there's a brief break. I'll just say a couple of words of introduction. Lisa was so efficient that I wasn't able to do that beforehand. But say welcome again to today's conference from the Freud Museum, and just a couple of sort of housekeeping things. As you probably know, your conference ticket means that you can go to the Freud Museum at lunchtime. This conference is actually in association with the exhibition Freud Murals Love, Lust and Longing, which is on display at the museum. So if you haven't yet seen that, please do go to the museum at lunchtime and have a look. If there are any issues during the course of the day, please do ask myself or one of my colleagues. If the room is too hot or too cold, which you can have a tendency to do when you say so. There are, on the boring news, there are toilets on this floor and the one above. If there were to be a fire or a fire alarm, just wait, you can go out into the garden there. If you haven't been to events here before and you are interested, please go on our website and sign up for our mailing list, or even better, support us by becoming a member of the museum. Yes, I think if you haven't picked up also all these various abstracts, biographies, recommendations of where you might go for lunch, those are all in the coffee room, and we're going to have a coffee break, I think, after this session. I think that's probably all as far as housekeeping, having interrupted the session and Miriam now being mic'd up. Thank you to all our speakers and over to Miriam.
Okay, can you hear me? Can everyone hear me? Okay, it's a tremendous honour to be here. Thank you, Lisa, for that amazing introduction. And hopefully some of the things we're going to say will relate back to some of these introductory remarks. We're both going to be talking on this topic, and we'll move backwards and forwards between us relating to our particular specialisms. So Freud gives us an impression of his understanding of deep love, or what he calls eros, in Beyond the Pleasure Principle. And this is a quotation. He says, "Anyone who considers sex as something mortifying and humiliating to human nature is at liberty to make use of the more genteel expressions eros or erotic. I might have done so myself from the first, and thus spared myself much opposition." So for Freud, eros is an alternative to the shocking and humiliating concept of sex. Its Greek equivalent is said to be genteel, and Freud imagines that he would never have got into so much trouble if he'd only dressed the wolf of psychoanalysis up in the sheep's clothing of Greek love. But is gentility what the ancient Greeks would have associated eros with? Would they have recognised Freud's concept of Greek love, at least in this particular passage? Eros, as Lisa has already mentioned, in ancient Greece referred not just to an emotion, but also to a deity. And there are lots of different versions of his identity, and even his parentage was contested. Some people say he was the child of Aphrodite, some people say he was... Plato famously says he's the child of poverty and plenty. So there are all sorts of stories around who exactly Eros was. But I think the least that one can say about him is that he wasn't much associated with an idea of gentility or respectable bourgeois respectability in the way that Freud invokes in this passage. One very canonical description of Eros comes from Sophocles' tragedy Antigone, and this is one of the choruses coming from towards about the middle of the play, and it's often called the Ode to Eros. And here Sophocles writes, "Eros, the unconquered in battle, Eros, you who descend upon riches and watch the right the night through on a girl's soft cheek, you roam over the sea and among the homes of men in the wild. Neither can any immortal escape you, nor any man whose life lasts for a day. He who has known you is driven to madness. You seize the minds of just men and drag them to injustice, to their ruin. You it is who have incited this conflict of men whose flesh and blood are one. But victory belongs to radiant desire, swelling from the eyes of the sweet-bedded bride. Desire sits enthroned in power beside the mighty laws. For in all this divine Aphrodite plays her irresistible game." So in this passage, what we get a sense of is how Eros has, as I've already mentioned, various forms, but the particular way in which it manifests itself in this play is first of all through the characterization of Eros driving people mad. He who has known you is driven to madness. And again, this is something that's already been mentioned, the association of love and desire with madness. And secondly, in that following sentence, you seize the minds of just men and drag them to injustice and to their ruin. This idea of eros driving people towards unjust acts and to ruinous situations. And he follows, it is you who have incited this conflict of men whose flesh and blood are one. And this is referring specifically to the situation at this moment in the tragedy in Antigone, where it is love which have driven families apart. The prelude to Antigone is about the murderous fratricide between Antigone's two brothers. So within one family, two people, two brothers who are driven to killing one another. But also in Antigone's case, her love for her brother sets her up in opposition to the state, to her own family, to her uncle, Creon, who's the king of Thebes, but also to the state as a whole, and she comes into conflict. So here we get the idea of eros as something that pits individuals at odds with themselves, with the family, and also with the state. And this is an image of eros. Here are more an adolescent eros, rather than a baby eros, from a red figure vase. And what we see is eros blinding a female figure as she stumbles into an erotic encounter. These are actually two sides of the same pot, which are juxtaposed together. But I think the image of eros is a force that blinds, a force that it's associated with the concept of madness, but drives this female figure into an unwise erotic situation. And this is very much the conception of eros that we get in Greek literature in general and culture more broadly. Women who succumb to eros almost always come a cropper in Greek literature. And this is the reason why. It's something which stands opposed to the idea of self-control, stands opposed to the idea of reason, in all sorts of different ways. I'm going to hand over to Dan, who's going to tell us about a different conception of Greek love.
Thank you. So if Miriam was talking about Greek love and women, or eros and women, another important angle of eros in classical Greek culture was the part that eros played for the relationships between men. And whereas eros often drove women mad on the tragic stage, eros was seen as a fundamental concept for an educative relationship which unfolded between an older man and a youth. That's to say, ancient historians believe that many Athenians and other Greeks during the classical period Athenian men were often engaged in pederastic relationships. So older men in their late 20s upwards engaged in intimate, maybe sexual, maybe non-sexual, but certainly emotionally intense relationships with boys aged from the age of 13, 14 upwards before they get married. Now, we're thinking about a culture when there wasn't a kind of state-subsidized education system. So if you were a kind of middle-class Athenian guy, a fat dad, and you want to educate your boy, you'd hire what was called a paedagogus. A paedagogus is a kind of private tutor. But at the same time, learning what it meant to be a man in classical Greek culture was also taking part in various social and political events or rites of passage. So it would be attending the gymnasium, where you wouldn't build up your body, but you'd go to the gymnasium and chat with other men about politics, current affairs. You might get to go on hunts as a young man and taken out into the wild and learn about how to do hunting. And on the other hand, you might also participate in what were called symposia or symposiums. And symposiums were fairly sort of formal occasions in which young men got together with older men and discussed politics, sung songs about love, had sex with one another, had sex with female prostitutes, and so on. Okay? So what we have then is eros becomes a central context for educating young men within the classical Greek polis. So unlike eros being associated with madness and driving women mad, Greeks often wrote about and believed that young men couldn't become adult men without engaging in some sort of erotic relationship with an older man. Okay? And what you have here is an image from a Greek pot of what? Of a, and of a pot which would have been used in a symposium, okay? Now, what you have here are a series of satyrs playing around with, you know, balancing pots on their penises. And what's kind of interesting about these sympotic images is that they often showed crazy sort of behavior, very transgressive, over the top, wild, abandoned sort of behavior. And these images were put in juxtaposition to the behavior we imagine was actually happening in the symposia themselves, in which young men were being inculcated with politics and poetry and topics of debate whilst getting intoxicated on alcohol. So symposia were places for young men and older men to engage in activity with one another, social and maybe sometimes sexual activity, where they were surrounded with images about how to behave and how not to behave. And this is an image precisely about how not to behave, okay? Now, at the same time as those sorts of images, we also have a very famous dialogue written by Plato in the early 4th century called the Symposium. And this is one of two dialogues about Greek symposia that we possess from the classical period. And in Plato's Symposium, he has a series of very famous Greek Athenian intellectuals discussing what love or what eros actually is. And one of the speeches early in the dialogue by a character called Pausanias really gets to the heart of how Athenians, everyday Athenians conceptualized what eros was for them. So here we have this first passage. The love who belongs to common Aphrodite is truly common and engages in his activity as opportunity offers. This is the love that inferior people experience. In the first place, men of this sort love women quite as much as boys, and secondly, their bodies more than their souls, and thirdly, the stupidest people possible, since they have regard only for the act itself, and do not care whether it's rightly done or not. Hence, their activity is governed by chance, and is as likely to be bad as good. So what we see, then, from this description of love is few things. So first of all, common in Greek is actually the word pandemos, which means literally pertaining to all the people, okay? So Pausanias says there's one type of love which is pretty common to most people, okay? And it's a kind of love that's associated with physical activity. It's a love that could occur between a man and a boy, but often it's between men and women. And it's often the love that, you know, the most everyday sort of folk engage with, the kind of the farmer outside Athens will fall in love in this sort of a way. It's the stupidest sort of folk who love like this, okay? Then Pausanias juxtaposes another type of eros, which goes like this. However, the love who accompanies the heavenly goddess and who does not descend from the female but only from the male is the love of boys. And that goddess is older and entirely free from wantonness. Hence, those who are inspired by this love inclined to the male, preferring what has by nature more vigor and intelligence. Moreover, even among men who love younger members of their own sex, it's possible to recognize those who are motivated purely by this heavenly love, in that they do not love boys before the stage when their intelligence begins to develop, which is near the time when they begin to grow a beard. Okay? So, that's about 13 to 14. Okay? And so, you see then is that Pausanias juxtaposes a kind of general type of love, which could be between a man and a boy, or often is between men and women, as opposed to this other type of what he calls heavenly love, or uranios love, literally in Greek, which is between a man and a boy. And it's bound up in this educative discourse. So he says that this sort of love can't happen until a boy reaches a certain level in which he can be intelligent, okay? So, this other sort of heavenly love is sharply distinguished from the kind of, you know, the common love, as well as the love that Miriam was talking about at the beginning. And so, we have lots of visual images on vases, lots of paintings on vases, showing what this sort of heavenly love would have looked like. This sort of image, you know, looks kind of weird to us now, but it's very common. If you go to places like the British Museum, you'll see these sorts of paintings on Greek vases. And so on the one side, here you have the older man who in Greek is called an erastes, and his age is signified by the fact that he has a beard and he has an erect penis, so he's an adult male, as opposed to the other side, the younger boy, who's called an eromenos, or the one who is loved, who is passive. And his youth is precisely signified by his smaller size, his smaller stature, and his non-erect phallus. So that takes us, I think I hand over to you.
Sorry.
Do you want this as well?
What we've been summarising is how Greek love has at least two features. One of them is this force for constructing male communities that Daniel's been talking about, an educative force, a force which has a form, in which sexual desire plays an important role, but is a kind of constructive model for the formation of communities and, you can hear me, right? education and communities. And the other is the destructive force that we witnessed at the beginning in relation to Antigone, the idea that Eros can be something that invades people from the outside, drives them to madness, and tears communities and families apart. Going back to Beyond the Pleasure Principle, this notion of Eros seems to be difficult to reconcile with Freud. In that passage that I was talking about a minute ago, he goes on to say, "I cannot see any merit in being ashamed of sex. The Greek word eros, which is to soften the affront, is in the end nothing more than a translation of our German word Liebe." Is the German word Liebe really a good translation of eros? He continues to suggest here that using the word eros is a form of softening of the affront, and then tries to analogize it to the concept of Liebe. I think Liebe carries with it, and we'll go on to talk about this, I'm sure, as the day progresses, romantic connotations. And I'm thinking here partly of the love letters between Freud and Martha, which are part of the exhibition. The concept of Liebe or love, we've already heard about the role of romantic novels and so on in the early history of psychoanalysis. The concept of Liebe seems to be compatible with a kind of boy meets girl kind of model, whereas Eros very rarely gives us that model of love. And I think the form of Eros that we've been talking about seems to be decidedly at odds with this particular construction of Liebe that we get in Freud. Nevertheless, what we want to do for the remainder of the paper is to think through how, despite the fact that in this passage and elsewhere perhaps in Freud's writing, he seems to be downplaying the sort of challenging and threatening aspects of Greek love, antiquity nevertheless played an extremely important role in the development of Freud's understanding of sexuality. And we want to show you how this was. And I think Dan's going to talk about the two aspects that we're going to be looking at.
Okay. So, if then Freud, even though he was, when he talks about Greek Eros, wasn't really talking about Greek Eros, what sort of antiquity was Freud engaging with in order to write the myth, psychoanalytic myths that he wrote? And what's interesting about Freud's engagement with antiquity then is that it actually emerges, Freud actually comes out of a late 18th century engagement with the ancient world. So, Freud firstly could not have theorized the Oedipus myth and the pre-Oedipal mother without the rediscovery of Pompeii. Now, Lisa very helpfully summarized the plot of Gradiva, so I don't have to do that, thank you. So, it's well known that the rediscovery, Gradiva was an important novel in Freud's intellectual development. And the rediscovery of Pompeii and Herculaneum around the 1750s was really a sensation across Europe and North America, in that the rediscovery of those two provincial Roman towns radically changed modern perceptions of the ancient world. So as opposed to the grandeur of ancient Rome and the kind of beautiful austere architecture of classical Athens, Pompeii and Herculaneum were altogether more kind of slightly kind of local provincial sorts of places in which people, archaeologists and tourists for the first time began to experience on a large level the everyday lives of the ancients. And one of the most interesting and shocking aspects of this rediscovery of Pompeii and Herculaneum for those 18th century viewers was the presence, the kind of seemingly ubiquitous presence of phallic artifacts all across the site. And what was interesting for archaeologists in the 1760s when they started in earnest excavating and disinterring in Pompeii and Herculaneum was that they couldn't, you know, dig without a day and not discover something phallic, okay? So, you know, there were phallic door knockers, bells and whistles, all sorts of things. You know, at Freud's house as part of the exhibition. And what was most interesting to these early viewers was that these phalluses weren't connected to a male body. And archaeologists and antiquarians at the time began to theorise and argue that the phallus was actually a symbol of fertility and nature's reproductive power. So there was one very, at that time, very famous English antiquarian called Richard Payne Knight, who wrote a book called A Discourse on the Worship of Priapus, and it came out in 1786. And here you've got an early page in this book, which actually show examples of objects that were discovered, and now you can actually see these objects now in the Archaeological Museum in Naples, where they're housed. And Richard Payne Knight began to try to theorise the history of religion, and he tried to kind of argue that all these phallic objects, all these phallic artefacts actually reflected something central about the religious culture of the ancient world. And he made this following argument. He said that the many-shaped god, the polymorphos and the muriomorphos of the ancient theologists became divided into many gods and goddesses, and often described by the poets as at variance with each other, and wrangling about the little intrigues and passions of men. Hence, too, as the symbols were multiplied, particular ones lost their dignity, and that venerable one which is the subject of this discourse, the god Priapus, the Roman god Priapus, became degraded from the representatives of the god of nature to a subordinate rural deity, standing among the nymphs by a fountain, and expressing the fertility of a garden. So Richard Payne Knight then argued that prehistoric man first became religious because he and she began to worship nature and began to have an interest in the reproductive and generative powers of nature. And as time went by, the earliest sculptures produced by man were express this kind of original nature worship. And Richard Payne Knight argued that the most logical way of representing this nature worship was by producing phallic sculptures. So Richard Payne Knight and several other of his contemporaries argued that ancient art began as religious art, and in particular phallic art, okay? And then he goes on to trace out in his book called Discourse on the Worship of Priapus how that ancient monotheism, that ancient phallic worship, then gets turned into, gets that original god gets divided up into all sorts of different gods, into the pantheon that we're familiar with in Greece and Rome. And the god Priapus, the Roman god of the gardens, who has this huge erect phallus which was used to guard, statues of Priapus were used to guard gardens in ancient Rome, and his large phallus, this god Priapus was the kind of remnant in ancient Rome of this even earlier ancient god, this phallic god that was worshipped right at the beginnings of mankind. But what also interested Richard Payne Knight was in this development of phallic worship and nature worship was that many ancient civilizations across classical antiquity and the Near East and India, we talked about India, Egypt and Greece and Rome, they often depicted a kind of mother figure with a phallus. So he argued that a crucial stage in the history of the development of religion was the worship of some sort of phallic mother or phallicized mother nature. And so what's very interesting then is that Freud's interest in the phallic mother, his theorization of the phallic mother, as he comes to theorize it in great detail in his Leonardo essay, actually comes out of his reading of this guy, Richard Payne Knight. You know, hardly a household name today, but in kind of 1908, 1909, Freud was reading Richard Payne Knight's discourse on Priapus, and he was writing with Jung. They were corresponding in some letters about how, you know, the book gets lost in the post and things like that. And eventually he gets it. And there's one very short footnote in the Leonardo essay in which he kind of cites Richard Payne Knight's essay. But actually the Leonardo essay is full of references, covert references, to Richard Payne Knight's discussions about this phallic mother nature worship. And so you see here in this quote from the Leonardo essay, which sounds very like Richard Payne Knight, mythology can teach us, Freud writes, that an androgynous structure, a combination of male and female sex characters, was an attribute not only of Mut, but also of other deities like Isis and Hathor. It teaches us further that other Egyptian deities like Neith of Sais, from whom the Greek Athena was later derived, were originally conceived of as androgynous. Mythology can then offer the explanation that the addition of a phallus to the female body is intended to denote the primal creative force of nature, that only a combination of male and female elements can give a worthy representation of divine perfection. So Freud's psychobiography of Freud then, which traces out Leonardo's highly intense relationship with his mother figure, comes out of his reading with Richard Payne Knight. And so it comes out of his engagement with this phallic antiquity that was being disinterred from the late 18th century onwards out of Pompeii right through the 19th century. And it's precisely the detachment of the phallus from the male body and its attachment to a female body that interests Freud, and that's what he gets out of Pompeii and Herculaneum. And some of the phallic amulets you can see on display in the exhibition in Freud's house, we think actually he bought in 1902 while he visited Pompeii. But at the same time as this very phallic antiquity was being disinterred in around the Bay of Naples, a very different antiquity in the late 18th century was also emerging. Another antiquity with which Freud was very interested. That's to say, it was an altogether more intellectual, idealizing view of the ancient world. So whilst many people were ferreting out phallic artifacts in Pompeii, a famous German antiquarian who lived in Rome, a guy called Joachim Johann Winckelmann, showed a complete disinterest in this phallic antiquity. And instead, Winckelmann wrote A History of Art, which was published in 1764, which constructed a totally idealized, white, marbled image of Greece. And the sculpture he loved the most is this one here, called the Apollo Belvedere, which you can still see now on display in the Vatican Museums in Rome. And Winckelmann describes the statue in these terms. The statue of Apollo is the highest ideal of art amongst all the works of antiquity that have escaped destruction. No veins or sinews heat and move this body, but rather a heavenly spirit that flowing like a gentle stream has saturated, as it were, every contour of this figure. I feel myself transported to Delos and to the Lycian groves, places Apollo honours with his presence, for my figure seems to take on life and movement. Now, what's interesting about Winckelmann's description is that he actually does go on to describe pretty much every contour of the figure. He describes Apollo's nostrils, he describes his eyebrows. You know, he really goes into a great amount of detail, but the one thing he doesn't talk about is Apollo's penis, okay, which, of course, is cut off, all right? So you have this kind of very strange setup. When you see a phallus in antiquity, it's not connected to a male body, and when you see a beautiful male body, it doesn't have a penis, okay? And so Winckelmann's move to idealize Greece then became very influential in Germany and across Western Europe to turn to Greece to look for perfection and beauty, okay? Greece became associated with the intellect, with Platonic truths, okay? And I think we'll turn to...
So one central figure in this emergence of a new conception of Greece, this idealized conception of Greece in which beauty played an extremely important role, but also the intellect played an absolutely fundamental role, the idea of the rediscovery of Greece. We're talking about the period of the Enlightenment at this moment, the rediscovery of Greece as the rediscovery of a form of reason. And one figure that was absolutely central to this reemergence of Greece was Oedipus. This idealized Oedipus was the moment in the Oedipus story that became kind of paradigmatic of this Enlightenment vision of Greece as the home of reason was Oedipus's encounter with the Sphinx. This is an image, both of these images, but this is the more canonical image by the painter Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres from 1808 of Oedipus's encounter with the Sphinx. And here we have Oedipus represented in all his intellectual triumph over an orientalized irrationality embodied in the Sphinx. The Oedipus that Ingres depicts here has his counterpart in a description of Oedipus by the philosopher Hegel, which is almost exactly contemporaneous with this image. He writes, "In the Egyptian nace, truth is still a problem. The Greek Apollo is its solution. His utterance is, 'Man, know thyself.' In this dictum is not intended a self-recognition that regards the specialities of one's own weaknesses and defects. It's not the individual that is admonished to become acquainted with his own idiosyncrasy, but humanity in general is summoned to self-knowledge. This mandate was given to the Greeks, and in the Greek spirit, humanity exhibits itself in its clear and developed form. Wonderfully, then, must the Greek legend surprise us, which relates that the Sphinx, the great Egyptian symbol, appeared in Thebes, uttering the words, 'What is it? That which in the morning goes on four legs, on midday, at midday on two, and in the evening on three. Oedipus, giving the solution, man, precipitated the Sphinx from the rock. The solution and liberation of the Oriental spirit, which in Egypt had advanced so far as to propose the problem, is certainly this, that the inner being of nature is thought, which has its existence only in the human consciousness." So here, Hegel associates Oedipus with the dictum, man, know thyself. There are some Freudian resonances in this idea of self-knowledge. But man, know thyself, in this context, is the discovery that humanity in general, self-knowledge, is linked to his identity as a figure of reason. Right? This is what Oedipus represents. And given this extraordinary emphasis on reason and the power of reason to overcome irrationality, one might say Orientalism is something I've already talked about in Egypt functions here, but also femininity in the representation of the Sphinx. It's somewhat ironic that this was the image that Freud had hanging in his consulting room, Oedipus. This was the image that Freud confronted every day when he was thinking about Oedipus and depiction. And Freud did have other images of Oedipus. This is a red figure vase that he had. But the interesting thing about this is that even in this other image, this much less neoclassical, much less sort of rationalizing depiction of Oedipus, the part of the myth that is represented here is again Oedipus in his encounter with the Sphinx. And this is the moment in the myth where Oedipus is presented in his identity of his extraordinary mental powers, and has very little to do with the Oedipus of incest and parricide, which is the centre of Freud's Oedipus complex. And that Freud was very interested in this moment is not just evident from this, but also in the fact that it was this image of Oedipus and his encounter with the Sphinx, which was presented to Freud on the medallion, which was commissioned by his students and given to him for his 50th birthday. this, again, this moment in the myth is compounded by the inscription which appears on the right here, which is a quotation from Sophocles' Oedipus Tyrannus, from the end of the play, where the chorus say of Oedipus, who knew the famous riddles and was a man most mighty. And here it is Freud in this presentation who's identified with Oedipus. He is the great man who solved the riddles of the unconscious. And Freud was clearly very flattered, and there are stories about the moment when he received this medallion and how he'd always anticipated this was going to happen. Ernest Jones talks about this in his biography. But the fact that he was very flattered by this is confirmed by the fact that he had a book plate made which reproduced precisely this image from the medallion, but also that quotation, in which Freud emerges as a kind of parallel to Oedipus, as a man of reason, a man of science, a man who was able to use his extraordinary intellectual powers to conquer the unconscious. So how does this image of Oedipus, which I've already said is somewhat at odds with the kind of Oedipus complex that we're familiar with, how does it square with Freud's first introduction of the Oedipus complex in the interpretation of dreams? This is what he writes there. He writes, "If the Oedipus Rex is capable of moving a modern reader or Plato no less powerfully than it moved the contemporary Greeks, the only possible explanation is that the effect of the Greek tragedy does not depend upon the conflict between fate and human will, but upon the peculiar nature of the material by which this conflict is revealed. There must be a voice within us which is prepared to acknowledge the compelling power of fate in Oedipus, and there is actually a motive in the story of King Oedipus which explains the verdict of this inner voice. His fate moves us only because it might have been our own, because the oracle laid upon us before our birth the very curse which rested upon him. It may be that we're all destined to direct our first sexual impulses towards our mothers and our first impulses of hatred and violence toward our fathers. Our dreams convinced us that we were. King Oedipus, who slew his father Laius and wedded his mother Jocasta, is nothing more or less than a wish fulfillment, the fulfillment of the wish of our childhood." So here, I think there are two aspects of Oedipus that seem to be competing with one another. We first have the aspect of Oedipus that we've been talking about, the Oedipus that Freud refers to here when he says the Greek tragedy does not depend upon the conflict between fate and human will. And there what he's saying is, contrary to what people think, this is not a myth about the conflict between Oedipus, a figure of human will, a figure who uses his mind, his intellect, to rage against the gods, really, to rage against necessity, to take his fate into his own control. He's saying that's not what the myth is about. The myth is about what we now know from Freud the myth is about. It's about the Oedipus complex. It's about the content of the desire, the idea of Freud's incestuous and murderous, of Oedipus's incestuous and murderous desires. And in order to construct this image of Oedipus, I think Freud had to reach back beyond this 19th century representation of Oedipus, which was clearly very influential for him in certain ways, back towards a different antiquity. And this he got from looking back at the play itself. And the reference to dreams at the end and the context of this within the interpretations of dreams obviously led Freud to a specific moment in Sophocles' Oedipus Rex where Jocasta and Oedipus talk about dreams. And in here, Oedipus says, "My mother, while she's still alive, I can't be safe. There's still that to fear." And Jocasta replies, "Fear? Why fear? We live our lives at the mercy of chance, the purest coincidence. No one can predict the future. So what is the point fearing it? Live, enjoy life, take each day as it comes. As for marrying your mother, you're not the first to have dreamed that dream. Every son is his mother's lover in imagination or in daydreams. It's commonplace. If a man broods on his most private fantasies, his life won't be worth living. Believe me." So here, it seems to me that Freud is reaching back beyond this sort of representation of Oedipus that we get in the 19th century towards a much more sexualized image of antiquity where each man dreams of sleeping with his mother. Image, I think, was not entirely absent. If we look at a different representation of Oedipus and his encounter with the Sphinx from later on in the 19th century in this picture by Gustave Moreau, not a picture that Freud displayed in his consulting room. But here we have an image which has a lot more in common with the kinds of things that Daniel was talking about. We have the Sphinx literally gripping on to a very passive-looking Oedipus, and an image, I think, of a much more sexualized encounter, one in which female sexuality clearly plays an important role. And I think Freud's Oedipus is in some sense a kind of hybrid figure. He's sort of half Ingres and half Gustave Moreau. He has aspects of the Oedipus associated with the Enlightenment, with the figure of intellect and reason, but he also has aspects, of this different association of antiquity with sexuality. Oedipus is attracted to his mother, and this is where we get that encounter, but he also is meant to triumph over his mother to become the adult child who's able to control his desires. He moves beyond the phallic mother that Daniel was talking about into adulthood. And I think we get both of those versions, the Oedipus of the medallion of Anne, but also this other Oedipus in Freud. But crucially, from the perspective of Greek love with which we started this paper, even within these two encounters, we still have Oedipus stuck within a kind of heteronormative patriarchal family. This is why the Oedipus complex is where critics point to when they want to accuse Freud of not being able to move beyond the bourgeois nuclear family. Even if this is a more threatening, sexualized image of antiquity, we still have here the idea of Oedipus stuck within this mummy, daddy, me structure, which seems to have very little to do with the idea of sexuality that we were exploring at the beginning of this paper. So I think what we've shown is that Freud is working in his theories with at least two images of antiquity, which track the plot of sexuality that he creates, where the pre-Oedipal child moves towards masculine mastery to become a man of science like Freud himself. What he leaves behind in that transition from the pre-Oedipal child towards the Oedipal child is all those threatening, difficult aspects of Greek love, the aspects of Greek love to do with, as Lisa was saying, the taboo of pederasty, of paedophilia, the ideas of Greek love were to do with destruction and madness. Some of that is there, but all these ideas of Greek love that we've been exploring. So it's ironic that Freud thought that he might find in Eros a respectable bourgeois subject when we confront it with all of these other aspects. And that's it.
Very interesting. You know, there's room here for a host of questions. I realize that we have, 5 minutes? Can you help me? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, just take a few now. We can come back to this material later because, of course, it feeds into much that will be talked about.
Yes. Hello. Thank you.
I'll take a few questions and then you can just answer.
Okay. Very interesting presentation. I wonder whether there was a difference between Athens and Sparta in the male young boys having relationships with older men, and to what extent the way we now look at it and say, well, this is kind of bordering on paedophilia, mm-hmm. whether in fact in Athens it was part of statehood building, mm-hmm. Which was something that we admire Athens and Greece for today, mm-hmm. And to what extent that was linked.
Yeah, I mean, I think thinking about the
just take a few questions at once, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Can you hold it?
Yeah,
yeah. My question is actually relevant. And coming from a psychological background and being also Greek, I was tempted. There was a mention in Athens that in his Symposium, Plato talks about these two types of eros or sex, one being the common one done by inferior people. I underline the word inferior in your slide, and the other being the heavenly one. So the one, the inferior one done by common people can be between men and women, but the heavenly one is between men and boys. So relating to your concluding remark about bourgeois aspect of eros and sex, I wonder whether the way that that eros is conceptualized in Athens in particular, I don't know whether this is in relation to other cities, as the previous speaker said, had something to do with the political organization of that specific city at the time with regards to states, hierarchies, who was entitled to what, women being able to vote, for example, etc. So I don't know how much political is relevant to how sex was perceived and whether it was the commoner and the inferiors and the ones that were more noble, as it were, and indeed whether this was different in other cities, that would be interesting to know.
Yeah. We'll take one more, if you can hold on to that. There was one more, I think. Okay, we'll just answer those two, if you want to start.
So the first question was about thinking about the differences between Sparta and Athens. So Sparta is famous for, you know, we get the word Spartan because we associate ancient Sparta with being a very authoritative, maybe totalitarian, very politically strict, maybe even repressive sort of state environment. What's interesting about Sparta for a historian is that a lot of what we know about, or what we think we know about Sparta, is through Athenian sources, which were written at a time when Athens and Sparta were at war with one another in what was called the Peloponnesian War. So our view of Spartan life in general doesn't come from Spartan writers. So we're quite limited to what we can say about Sparta. What people think or believe, and this is the problem with classicists, is that there's so little evidence, so we have to just believe a lot of things. Women were involved in state education more than they were in Athenian education. That's one thing that people believe, but we can't prove it. So there's a kind of big contrast between Athens and Sparta, but the way we understand Sparta is through a prism of Athenian writings. And I think the second question, I would just adumbrate what you said, is that, you know, yes, these ideas about eros were part of a political, were playing into a political context, absolutely. The pederastic relationship was part of a building block amongst a whole other load of bricks, which were about building the state, reproducing the state. You know, older men teaching younger men how to behave is a form of reproduction, you know, and it's about how men are controlling, you know, reproductive activities, cultural and intellectual reproduction. So when Socrates, later on in Plato's Symposium, Socrates talks about the pederastic relationship, and he talks about a pederast being pregnant with beautiful ideas. So he uses metaphors about pregnancy and giving birth to beautiful ideas about truth and so on. So the pederastic relationship for at least certain Athenian intellectuals was associated with kind of taking control of reproduction. And that was a political act.
I mean, it is clear that in certain points during this very long history of Greece, that in fact, you know, homosexuality was also looked down on, and men were meant to marry. It was bad to be celibate. Mm. So the whole kind of reproductive picture comes into that as well. Sorry, did you want to?
Do we have room for one more? Because there's someone. Otherwise, I'll answer this. I don't know. Maybe Kate.
This is. I wondered. I was reminded of a production of Oedipus I saw at the Old Vic in the late. I think it was 1968 with my father, and it was the most extraordinary production, which ended with a sort of giant golden phallus being unveiled, which had stood there for the whole of the production.
Right.
The chorus was strapped to the columns, and then at the end they all unstrapped. And the jazz band sort of came up into the auditorium, and then everybody danced around it. And I just wonder whether there were any elements of the carnival in Pompeii, and you know, that because it sort of really did give us. I remember the feeling. I mean, I was about 17, and it was a I didn't understand it at all at the time. But you know, but what was wonderful was it seemed to sort of actually very much sort of be a very sort of joyful and sort of bringing the phallus down to earth. They were all, it was a brown set.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I'm not sure about, there must have been carnivals in Pompeii, but certainly when theatre was performed in Athens, it was in a carnival festival atmosphere, and before comedies were performed, a massive wooden phallus was paraded around the city, and this festival is called the Phalaphoria, which is Greek for the carrying of the phallus, and that's meant to have kind of meanings about fertility and the crops growing and all that sort of stuff, but also this kind of large erect phallus is kind of a signifier of, you know, a kind of a carnivalesque sort of atmosphere where the city's social norms can be inverted, you know, slaves have the day off and stuff like that. So it had a political, social meaning as well. It's erect phallus, political license,
I think we've got time for one more if anybody. There's one there, yes. Do you want to bring the mic or can you?
Could I just make a very quick comment about when you've been talking a lot about the phallus and men coming together, reproduction of ideas. Of course, men couldn't get pregnant and have babies. So I was just thinking about, you know, the role of, you know, the juxtaposition in a sense of the two. Because do we have lots of statues of pregnant women in antiquity?
I don't think so. No, there's a goddess of childbirth.
Yes, that's
certainly.
Right.
So that's important.
But it's also important to do with this is that the pederastic relationship, as Daniel was marking, is a stage of development, and so there's still an expectation that these young male Athenians will go on past their pederastic relationships towards having heterosexual, married life in which they'll produce citizens and so on and so forth. And if we contrast that interestingly with the image that I had of Antigone at the beginning, Antigone's name means anti-generation, and Antigone chooses to this incestuous relationship with her brother. I mean, some people contest the extent of incest, but she chooses to honour her brother at the expense of getting married and having children herself. And this was clearly a huge worry for Athenians. So it's not that they were anti-generative. The production of male citizens through heterosexual relationships was clearly an incredibly important part of the ideology of Athens, together with this idea. And so Plato is an interesting figure. We talked a little bit about the politics of this. Plato is not a democrat, and so when he uses the word pandemos to talk about the kind of love between men and women, when he uses this kind of idea that this is part of a kind of democratic idea, that anyone can do this, he's contrasting it to a different idea, a more hierarchical idea of politics in which authority, knowledge, etc. are the more valued ideas. And that's why he thinks that form of pregnancy is a higher form of pregnancy. The conceptual pregnancy of ideas is something which is a higher form, and that is related to his political idea that he developed in the Republic, where he thinks that the people who should be producing political ideas are philosophers and figures who are above the kind of democratic love that we get there. It's actually a very complex ideology. It's not that the pederastic relationship was cancelled out all the ideas about the importance of female love, but the sense in which women were not agents in that is extremely important.
Can I just add, because it reminds me of, you know, when we talk about Freud in this context, and we look at images, there's a real sense to me, I mean, you could all argue with this, that Freud's imagination and his understanding is much more narrative-based than imagistic. Mm-hmm. And the thing about images is they stop time. And Freud's technique, of course, that he develops is psychodynamic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is about movement, and it's about movement through life. So that when you talk about the Oedipus, you talk about the Oedipal story. Mm-hmm. It's something that shifts and changes. Yeah. When you look at images, of course, they're time-trapped. I mean, they stop, and they're wonderful, potent do I use that word, representations, but they're only one moment.
It is interesting how many that Freud was so interested in the material lanes and of antiquity. The fact that he could, he, you know, so that image of Oedipus may not be, as you say, it's clearly in dialogue with a much more narratival version. But the fact that he surrounded himself with all of these physical objects
of
from antiquity,
and he could tell stories about them.
He could exactly. But that's an interesting sort of dynamic.
Absolutely. And of course, in his love of antiquity is also the whole notion. Everybody in this room probably knows this, but I just underline it, of excavation,
yeah,
of actually,
yes,
you know, going absolutely into, yeah, the ground, yeah, and finding, yeah, these things. And that, too, has a metaphorical weight. So one more question, then coffee break.
I think,
yes,
Betty has to
quickly. Oh, sorry, this lady has been waiting. Just quickly, yes.
Okay, so...
Override.
Quick.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Because we're talking today about Freud and the Europeans that preceded him, I'm very grateful you brought up the question of Orientalism. We're constantly talking about how a certain group of people interpreted ancient Greece, interpreted Sparta, interpreted the rest of the world. Of course, there are more contemporary images of all of these things. There is Gilbert Hurd's anthropological study of the, excuse me, of the Papua New Guineans, the Zambians, and how, excuse me, young boys are taken into the men's longhouse and practice oral sex. And it's a way of separating them from women and the love of towards their mothers, of masculinizing them, as in opposition to there being the danger of feminizing them through their mothers. Equally, I don't know of any androgynous women in Hindu mythology, but they're certainly the lingam, the erect phallus, stood within the yoni. So these are very different ways of conceptualizing masculinity and eros, but they don't seem to come in even today when we talk about them. We make reference to Orientalism and then we stop. It's a pity. Mm.
It's interesting because I just noticed it actually when we were giving our talk on, when Freud in the Leonardo caption I had, he mentions the Egyptian goddess Neith, and then actually
Hegel
does this as well, and Neith for Hegel is this kind of oriental other, an example of what the West will conquer, whereas when Freud gets to it, it's a pre-Oedipal, again, it's another object to be conquered, you know. But in the 18th century context, Richard Payne Knight and those sort of late 18th century Orientalists were in a moment in, there was a moment in time there was a more ambivalent relationship with Indian religion as it was being discovered, you know.
Well, don't forget, so, some of Freud's statuary is, of course, from points east. It's not all Greek by any means.
Yeah.
Okay, 20 minutes for coffee, and then we come back and move on to romance.